Dr. Brinke, thank you very much for joining us this evening. We really do appreciate it. Let's just play a game of what if.
What?
Let's play a game of what if. Okay? I have a magic wand in my hand.
Oh, yeah.
Can you hear me? Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. My question for Dr. Brinke is this. I have a magic wand in my hand, and I've agreed to give you 271 electoral votes. So you're going to be the next president. And I've decided as well that we here are the Congress. So whatever you want to enact, we're going to enact. What are three proposals that you would enact to help improve our system to be more in line with some of the things you're talking about tonight? What are three major reforms that you would support?
Well, you know, I have a whole, in the contrary notions, I have a whole selection called what is to be done. There's no, and there's even one in the back of democracy for the few. There's no mystery. That would be a drastic cut in the defense budget. There would be withdrawal from Afghanistan and Iraq. There couldn't be three. There'd have to be many. A bringing back of the estates tax, which was the most progressive tax because it taxed the very rich. It wouldn't affect your inheritance. You could have a totally free inheritance to your children up to $2 million. It's only after that that you'd have to pay a tax, a progressive tax on it. So those are the beginnings. Stop agribusiness, put a real defense for organic foods and such, all sorts of moves for the green economy. There's no shortage of things. We know what desperately needs to be done. So we don't need any magic wands. We need the power, unfortunately, because those who have the interest for such changes don't have the power, and those who have the power don't definitely have the interest. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
That's my magic wand at home, so I won't preface my question with that. Just because you were talking about the Iraq War, it seems to me that the whole lack of efficiency and the lack of any sort of foresight was on purpose. And so the clusterfuck was intended, that like it's easier to have an ongoing mess than a...
If you're going to talk like that, I mean...
Oh, great.
I
thought maybe you had that word in there.
Would you want to translate that to a less colloquial phrase?
Well, it just seems to me that the mess is convenient. Like, it's just convenient that there's every month a new mess to clean up, and then kind of perpetuates the need to clean it up. And then, like you were talking about, the dominant paradigm seems to be that, well, in 2 months it'll be better. And so every 2 months there's a new 2 month kind of bridge to cross.
Well, I don't know about that. I mean, I think they would have liked a nice, lean, clean victory where the oil lines would be not bombed and broken, and where they could get this oil totally controlled and put in a puppet government that would serve them, you know, as in Kosovo, for instance. They would very much like that. So I don't think that it doesn't mean they may not get certain kinds of secondary spin-off benefits from the mess, which is fatter contracts and more Halliburton opportunities for profiteering and the like.
Okay, no more after you.
Does that make sense what I say? Let me give you an example, a better example than the war, though, where I actually have written about this, and that's Katrina. People keep thinking that Katrina was mismanaged. It wasn't mismanaged. They had FEMA down there. They turned away every single volunteer. The whole nation sent an outpouring of food and blankets and medicines and volunteer teams, firefighter teams, medical teams came from all over the country. And FEMA and Homeland Security blocked them out, warehoused them, put them back. Even while the medical personnel in the Astrodome were begging for help and for amounts. So it was like, let them suffer, let them bleed, let it break. They wanted to break New Orleans. They wanted to break. New Orleans was a very intense and very politicized Democratic stronghold. It swung Louisiana state elections on any number of occasions. So they displaced it. They whacked it. There are things they could have done. It was totally, they had no interest in saving those people. The people they brought in were people with guns. Were hunting down looters, while there were others drowning in their attics. People died, hundreds of people died who could have been saved and weren't saved. So, and there's that Republican congressman, I got the quote, I don't remember his name, he said, we couldn't get rid of all that public housing, but God did it for us. It wasn't God, it was George W. Bush. He knew, he had been told repeatedly that those levees, even the Army Corps of Engineers said, those levees aren't going to last, the next hurricane is going to break them open. New Orleans did not perish in the hurricane. New Orleans was hardly hit by the hurricane. Mississippi was hit harder than New Orleans. New Orleans perished in the flood. It was those waters that came in. I wrote about that, again, in contrary notions. This is becoming an infomercial. or you can get it, you can actually get it right on my website. It's called How the Free Market Killed New Orleans. And if it's not on my website, it would be on ZNet. So it's kicked around. What?
Thanks for
fun. Well, not everybody can buy it. You know, not everybody's as rich as you, Josh. A little louder, please. People in the cheap seats can hear you.
Hello?
Yeah.
Okay.
You got to talk like that if you really want to.
Well, one comment about the media, you kept seeing on TV is that white people were finding food and black people were stealing food. But the other thing I want to mention is about the media is the presidential debate. Now, what I kept seeing as we started to see who was going to pull ahead, we started to see exclusion of different people was it John Edwards, Barack Obama, and Hillary Clinton were in the Las Vegas debate, for example, and they excluded Dennis Kucinich. And if you look at who was on the debate, it was MSNBC who did the debate. They're owned by GE. So I just didn't know if you think it was more of the exclusion was more of party politics or if it was more of private capital influencing what they wanted to hear or not. He's the only one that has a differentiating view from all the rest of them. Not just him, but there's other candidates
for the other party. No, that's right. They excluded Dennis Kucinich under the guise that he wasn't a serious candidate. You see, there are three primaries going on. You've got to understand. There's the voting primary that you vote. But then there's two others. There's the media primary, and then there's the money primary. And those are the ones where Kucinich couldn't even get his foot in the door. And even John Edwards was, the early polls showed that John Edwards could beat any Republican. And he was a fairly progressive, not as much as Kucinich. Kucinich was a really militant on that one. But even Edwards said, it's not a fight between the rich and the poor, it's a fight between the very super rich and all the rest of us, which is a good analysis, actually. Again, I got an article called The Super Rich Are Out of Sight, so take a look at that one. But Kucinich, I always say Kucinich was not shut out by the media. He was not even allowed to exist. I mean, there wasn't, he was just a non-person, that's all. Nobody can hear him. You can hear him in little individual conventions, you know, word of mouth, whatever. But he got no time on the major media. The only time he ever got on major media was when a reporter asked him if he had ever seen a UFO, and he said, yes, I had. And that's the only exposure he got. So to show that he's a crook, that they had time, they found that significant. And the purpose of that, of course, is to show that he's a kook. So, okay. So that's my answer. They lost the media primary, and they lost the money primary, too. If you don't have the money, then you're not a serious candidate. So what makes you a, quote, serious candidate, as opposed to frivolous and ha-ha-ha candidate, is how the money interests control you. So those are the primaries. You have to win the media primary. And the two, they declared from the very beginning, the two front runners were Barack Obama, who has a Middle Eastern name and has some African-American blood in him, along with a lot of other blood, and Hillary Clinton, who's white, and is Hillary Clinton, which is another problem. And so, these two candidates had major problems, and those are the ones they declared to be the leaders, the leading candidates. And we never really got a chance to hear what any number of the other ones had to say. Yeah. So it looks like McCain may very well win.
Had a question about the media. First of all, I want to congratulate you and for your criticism on the media. I think it's very true and admirable and impressive. And I'm actually a journalism student.
Why don't you put that in writing and I can use it on your dust jacket or the next book.
I wanted to talk to you about that. No, well, the thing is, I'm a journalism student and we learn in our classes how to frame stories and how to be objective and whatnot. But when you see the coverage of Vietnam and even the Iraq War, you notice that journalists who do try and report the truth on what is going on overseas, they get lambasted and blacklisted by talking heads and politicians.
And by their own editors sometimes.
Of course, of course.
Publishers, yeah.
And I wanted to ask you how you think that me as a feature reporter and maybe some other people here in this room, what we can do to change that and how we can seek the truth in our reporting and not be, I guess, burdened or tied down by our editors or readers, the public, or how do you stay truthful to them?
Well, it's not easy. When I wrote Inventing Reality and did other media studies, I began noticing that the journalists who had critical perspectives of, you know, what went on and how things were manipulated and how they were controlled were often all ex-journalists. And the ones who were still working journalists, I found, the ones who got along, you know, they were very hostile to me. I thought they would greet the book and say, oh, this really is eye-opening. How naive I was. But you know the Upton Sinclair quote, which is, you can't get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his misunderstanding it. So, and that, I thought, describes most of the journalists. So you would be seen as a kind of someone. There's a whole vocabulary that says you're getting too close to the story. You're getting emotional about it, or well, we've already done that, we've covered it, but you never covered this and this and this. No, we've covered that, we've had enough on such and such, you know. And any number of people have said that when you start writing, the weeklies all around the country refrain from ever publishing anything about anybody who has any serious amount of political economic power. Now that's not always true, sometimes you can get some good muckraking. What you can do is just try to wedge in and try to, you know, get something in there, make an appeal to the question of being balanced, and that balance means not staying in the middle, but giving different perspectives. And also writing for alternative journalism, alternative media. You have to develop a taste for poverty to work for the alternative media. Well, that's what I did for years after when I got driven out of academia. I just lived, you know, group houses and such. It wasn't easy. I used to see, you know, friends who I knew in grad school at Yale getting their chairs at eminent universities or getting their sabbaticals off in Cambridge and England and such. I did win a few awards. I managed to survive half a foot in academia, but it was hard. But I wasn't going to compromise. I wasn't going to start saying things that I didn't believe. How could you even do that? How could you even live? How could you stand there? That's something you can't do. So I wish you luck. No, I mean it. I hope you. There's a few good, and sometimes you can see a story that's better by the particular journalist. Every so often, you know, there'd be a journalist who really knows it, put some of that extra information in there, which you don't often see someplace else. Those aren't the ones who become the bureau chiefs, though, and then the editors, and then the presidency.
Well, your son does a good job at that, and...
Yeah, my son just got... Now, how the hell did he do that? I mean, he got that article on cocoa and the cocoa farmers on the Ivory Coast as the lead article in Fortune magazine. Yeah, he did a good job of it. But he doesn't have... No, he doesn't have a big position. He's not, you know... He's not bureau chief of NBC, or... He doesn't get... He got one... He was on the, what's it called? Neil Lehrer Report. What did they pronounce it? Jim Lehrer Report? Is that what it's called?
PBS.
What?
NewsHour.
Jim Lehrer NewsHour. Yeah, and it's treated in a disgusting fashion by Jim Lehrer, that slimy. He talked about how these things weren't being rebuilt in Iraq. He'd been to Iraq two times, three times. He'd been risking his life. I mean, much to the grief of his parents, who didn't want to see him go to Iraq when they're shooting at journalists and all that stuff. I remember him saying to me, "Don't worry, Dad, I'm careful." I said, "Yeah, careful people don't go to Iraq." But on that show, he persisted and said, "No, the utilities haven't been, the water systems haven't been reconnected. This hasn't been." And what did Lehrer do? 2 days later, he said, We want to apologize for the lack of objectivity that was shown in that show," meaning him, you know. And that became a whole dust up. And he's never been asked back. And then Lehrer got such crap that he backpedaled, said, "Oh no, we didn't mean that. We just meant that there should maybe have been a little more diversity." But that's exactly what he meant, because right after the show, one of the producers called Christian and said, "You were way out of line persisting on that argument and saying." What was he supposed to say? "Oh, excuse me, yeah, I should not have been so persistent about what I saw and found with my own eyes there." Okay, last question. I gotta go anyway.
I got two questions for you.
Two? No. You think because you're the last guy, you get two questions?
I wanted to pick your brain on post-Castro Cuba and whether it economically is gonna stay as a communist nation, or if it's gonna open its doors, or where it's actually going. And my second question is on Hugo Chavez and Vladimir Nismo, and whether or not the U.S. hegemony is eventually gonna conflict to a point where they're both gonna end up going to war.
Cuba, I imagine that Cuba will start changing, yeah, because the younger generation, I think the way communism is put in today is it's an incredible success in lifting people from the most abysmal third world poverty, and even in the case of China and Russia, from serfdom, middle-aged serfdom, medieval serfdom, to hundreds of millions of people getting educations and jobs and living decent lives and eating food. I mean, that's a historical accomplishment unmatched. But these systems are designed to subvert themselves. If you were to sit there for the CIA and say, "How do I work a system that's designed to subvert itself?" These systems are designed that way. And I think Cuba is, it has a whole younger generation that takes them free medical care, housing, education. Takes it totally for granted. They just think, "I was born with that. What do I want?" And they want really jazzy shirts. They want the things they see on TV. They want this, that, the other thing. You come with a political T-shirt, but you come with some really dressy, something special. They want cars. They want all that stuff. And there are a lot of people who are discontent because the system is designed to make everything almost free, and then you pay people, "Why work, you know? And I can't have nothing to buy with this money." So it's a mess. I have a chapter in my book, Black Shirts and Reds. It's called Communism in Wonderland. It's very critical of existing communism, and it tries to explain why in many ways it undermines itself. Plus it gets undermined and pressured from everybody around. Cuba would be a much more prosperous place if it could trade with the U.S. and the like. Okay, and the other question was, will Venezuela and the U.S. come to blows eventually? Well, I don't know. I hope not. I think Hugo Chavez is a wonderful leader.
He's literate. He's very intelligent. He has worked hard and done inspiring work in Venezuela. Venezuela in the last 2 years has had a growth in its productivity, a growth in employment, a bettering of health. I visited health clinics. I visited dental clinics. There's the book right there. She's got it, see? Black shirts and reds. Sure, I'll sign it. Those are both crystal ball questions. I mean, I don't know, but what you can say is Chavez should emphasize the fact that he is willing to get along and live with the U.S. And he shouldn't, you know, be saying, come on, you want to duke it out, let's go. At least that's the way they're portraying him. And he has said things about he's quite willing to live with him. He went too far with the referendums. I felt that instinctively. And he got voted down. But he's still wildly popular. The people really do appreciate having a leader who is really doing something for the people. And he has an army at his back. Most of the 40, especially the Lee Corps, the paratroopers, they're on his side. And any showdown, you may find some barracks somewhere in some other place where some of the generals are, you know, going the other way or playing footsies or whatever. But he should have been a little firmer on the crackdown after the overthrow of the coup. He should have really arrested a lot of those guys. They had committed treason. They had undermined the democracy, and they were working for the CIA. At least kick them out. Well, that's about it. There's so much more we could talk about. Why talk when I can go eat now? Thank you.